Hey, how you doing? Thank you so much for joining us. This is the Venice Voice Podcast. On this episode of the Venice Voice, I will be joined by author Nick Miller. We're going to talk a little bit about his novel, Isn't It Pretty to Think So, and what inspired him to write it. Also, we're going to talk a little bit about his transition into screenwriting and film directing, and a couple of things about how he met his wife and some of the projects that he and I have worked on, and some issues that are going on around our neighborhood here in Venice. But first, I'd just like to remind you that this podcast is for you. So, if you'd like to be interviewed, or if you want to talk about an upcoming event or a product that you're working on, anything at all that's going on in your world, shoot me an email at ron@venicevoice.com. Now, without further ado, here's Nick Miller. So, what's going on, Nick Miller? How you doing?
Good.
Good. Thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to be here.
It's so nice to just be able to sit and have a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's rare that I get to hang out with you at all. I mean, we've done some creative projects together, and that's been really fun. But to just sit down and to learn more about you is a really great opportunity. So thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. Yeah, I guess we don't get to do this unless we're actually working on something. So this is cool.
We might as well work on something.
Yeah, exactly. Here we go. Let's work on this.
Where are you from originally, man?
I'm from Orange County. I was born in Santa Ana. And then when I was in high school, we moved to Dana Point. And then my parents now live in Irvine. So that sort of maps out my childhood.
Little too. Southern California boy.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah, I never would have guessed that. I thought you seemed like an East Coast guy to me.
Yeah, I don't want to, talk shit on Orange County, but, I'd never felt connected there. I never felt a part of that community, so I was happy to get out when I did.
Yeah, you also, and you went to Berkeley.
Yes, that changed my life.
Yeah.
So that fully, adjusted my perspective, opened my eyes. It showed me that there's something else other than this homogenous lifestyle community that I was a part of for so long. So that, Berkeley is a great place to go. If it's rich in diversity, it's very challenging. It seriously changed my life.
So. Well, that sounds like a place that you would be from. It seems like you would fit in there.
Oh yeah, that opened me up, and that made me realize that there's other people like me, struggling like me, curious like me, and I felt at home for the first time when I was there. So
I went to college in San Francisco. I went to San Francisco State, right across the bay.
Yeah.
And went to theater school there. I was born in Oakland.
Nice.
So I grew up in the East Bay.
Yeah.
And it was the same type of experience for me when I moved into the city from the East Bay, because I grew up in Pleasant Hills, like the valley of Northern California, very homogenous, very suburban. And once I moved into the city, it completely opened my eyes. And I went to theater school, and it was amazing how much I was exposed to in such a short amount of time, and it completely changed my perspective
100%.
As an artist, just as a citizen of the world, if you will.
Yep.
And, yeah, so in some ways, I think we have that kind of perspective in common.
For sure. Yeah, I liken that experience to traveling. Just traveling in general. Whenever you go to a different country, or you come back a different person, and I think that it's always good for people to get out of their comfort zones and experience something new.
Most Americans don't travel enough.
No, not enough.
They really don't.
It's like, what was the crazy statistic about passports? Like, most Americans don't even have a passport. So, that's pretty embarrassing. We need to get out there more, because we'd all probably be a little bit more united if we traveled more and saw the world a little bit more.
I agree. Getting out of our comfort zone and having a little perspective, for goodness sake.
Absolutely.
To see us the way the world sees us is a very eye-opening experience.
Yeah, it's embarrassing where we stand right now with all that. But
well, that's a rabbit hole we don't necessarily need to go down.
Sidestep
we
that.
We don't need to do that right now. So, when did you first start writing? I know that you're a published author. You had this novel that did pretty well.
Yep.
When did you first start writing?
I started writing, as a kid, I'd write little plays, and the neighborhood kids or friends would play my characters, and that was the first taste of of writing, of the feeling of writing something, and the feeling that that gave me to create words that sort of played out in front of an audience. That was my first experience, and I never looked back. I always wrote poems, little thoughts, short stories. As a young kid, I started pursuing it more seriously in college. I had a website that I started with my roommate that was called The Heel Press, and it basically was a group of writers that got together and submitted stuff online. And then there was like this behind the curtain, a place where they could critique each other and help each other improve their work before they pushed publish, and they would be out for the public. This started as a small little project in Berkeley, and then it ended up traveling to all the UCs. And I ran the website with my partner, but I also wrote under a pseudonym, and that was when I got that real feeling of seeing people react to my work. And there's this sort of mystery around who this person was, because it was a pseudonym.
What was the pseudonym?
Michael Reed.
Michael Reed.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would publish fiction, short stories, all this stuff, and I developed a big following among all the UC schools, and then it caught on to other schools as well. And we had actually a pretty active website and a business for a while.
It turned into a business. Nice.
Yeah. So we ran that for like 5 years.
And it's still running now?
No, it's defunct now. But we got some good, you get some press. We got a lot of writers. It was a great experience. So that was my, when you write, it's a very vulnerable thing. So the pseudonym helped me kind of get a voice without being so vulnerable. And then when I realized I could do that, then I jumped in with my name and pursued it, seriously.
So establishing that pseudonym gave you the freedom to fully express yourself?
Yeah. And I remember the first time that I submitted something, I started writing, a piece that started off as serious fiction. And then about a paragraph in, I transformed it into a parody piece because I was so scared of writing fiction. Because it's very easy to write terrible fiction and to be exposed sort of as a fraud or as someone who,
who's this guy trying to write fiction?
Exactly. Where
is he coming from? That type of thing. It leaves you open to being very critical, people being very critical of your work.
And, if that happens too early on and you're not ready for it, that could probably damage you to a point of no return. So And I remember when I got feedback on the piece, a few people wrote in saying they were loving where the fiction was going. And why did I sort of switch out and do this parody satire piece? It was because I was scared. So that pseudonym helped me just develop the skills behind this curtain. And then, now obviously right under my real name.
And I think Berkeley had another pretty profound effect on your life, considering you met your wife there. Is that correct?
Okay, so here's the thing. She was a freshman when I was a senior, so we'd never actually met at Berkeley.
You didn't meet at Berkeley, but you were there at the same time.
Well, she transferred. She was at she transferred her junior year, so we actually weren't there at the same time.
Oh, okay.
But here's the crazy thing, and it gets even better. We didn't meet at Berkeley. We met a few years later in L.A., and she was in a book club, and they read my book in the book club. And then she tracked me down through my sister, who was also in the book club, to meet me.
Really?
Yeah.
So she stalked you, basically.
She did, yeah. And she'll admit that. She's proud of that. But so, she was texting me through my sister's phone. And I kept telling my sister, I was like, I just come off finishing the book. And I was sort of in this very hermit, bearded lifestyle, and I hadn't seen people in a while, and I was a little bit angry and like hidden away. I was thinking I was staying in Palm Springs at my parents' place, and I kept getting this text from this girl, and she was just relentless. And I told my sister, I said, tell your friends to leave me alone, in sort of this blunt, way. And then Cammie was not deterred from that, and she pursued and pursued, and then finally we had a real conversation, and that real conversation turned into her coming to visit me in the desert for 4 days, and now we're married, and now we have a baby.
Wow. And congratulations on that, by the
Thank
way.
Thank you.
Thank yeah. you. Yeah, that's, yeah. I'm so very happy for you guys. You seem like so grateful to be in the situation that you are as, that you're in as parents.
Yes.
That's a very lucky young lady that you guys have to have such loving parents.
Yeah,
I'm really happy for you guys.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we're so in love. Everyone told us that, you know, it's the greatest thing ever, and everyone has advice and insight, but you just don't know until it hits you. And for me, just I've never been quite filled with a love like that. It was sort of just like a switch turning on, and there was this biological need in me to protect, to love, to think about the future, to, you know, all of those things. And it's a blessing. It's a gift. It really is. So I'm thankful that I have her.
It's astonishing to me. I have a number of friends who have gotten married kind of young, like yourselves. And I get the sense from them that, not all of them, but some of them, I just get the sense that they didn't fully understand what they were getting into. Sometimes people get married young and there's a whole romance around it. They don't have a real plan. There's not a lot of stability around it. And they just sort of jump in with both feet, not fully understanding that. I don't get the sense of that from you guys. It seems like a pretty solid situation that you've created for yourself here.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we got...
And you have a lot of support around you. You guys, you know, we're so blessed, and you guys are so blessed that you come from such great families.
Yes,
and
that's a big thing, is the families are very involved. Yeah, but interesting on that is that I think, for me at least, this journey has... sort of in illuminated to me what a real commitment is, and I think even when you get married, you're committing, but you're in love, and you're wrapped up in each other, and you're engrossed in it, and it seems simpler. And then there's this sort of incredible grandiose thing that happens, and you're introduced to a phase where you're partners for a second. You're rolling up your sleeves and you're getting through this thing together, because there's something more important happening. And then it's the understanding that you're going to come back around. And I think that's what, to me, what commitment has become. It's like, we're doing this, we're sacrificing a little bit of ourselves, our previous life, so that we could do this together. We're committing to it. I'm going to be here no matter what. You're going to be here no matter what. And we're going to come out the other end.
Well, there's something to be said for a situation that once you've decided to do it, there's no not doing it. You kind of just have to plow forward. There's no not doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
So it forces people to band together in a way that's much different than a casual relationship.
Yes, yes. And I think that's where probably a lot of the problems, when you start, you know, envisioning or fantasizing about something else or a different life, and you just kind of you stray away from that commitment. Mm-hmm. You know, like getting, because there's so many great, but it's tough in the beginning. It's like, holy shit, there's a whole new, you know, adjustment happening here. Like, you're not sleeping.
I remember one time you told me, I was like, how's it going, man? And you're like, well, Cammy hates me right now, and probably will for a long time, but everything's great.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just knowing that you're going to get through that, you know? And and then you got this beautiful little, you know, kid that, and then, you know, maybe more, and then life happens, you know? And then another thing I was worried about, and I think I even spoke to you about this, is like, what's going to happen to my creative life? What's going to happen to my work life? Is it going to affect me? Like, are my dreams done? You know, because when you choose to have a child, you're choosing to put your child ahead of your dreams, in a sense, you know? But I didn't want it to be the death of it. And the really refreshing, cool thing for me that I've come to experience is that now I'm just much more disciplined with my time, and I get more stuff done, because I'm like, I don't have the luxury now to like spin in my chair and think of ideas for 8 hours straight. Now I have a concentrated time where I have to go in there and get stuff done. And that's been cool. And that, I think that will inspire other people that are worried about that.
Well, this whole situation that you're in now, and with the family and Cammy, is kind of a byproduct of you writing that book.
Yeah.
Because if she hadn't read it, she probably wouldn't have found you.
Oh, yeah.
It must be, it's a heck of a book.
Yeah, and it's, all things, you know, you know, I got Cammy out of it. You know, I got a daughter out of it.
If nothing else.
So,
well, it's a fun read. I really enjoyed reading the book, and it reminds me of some of the times in my life, because I used to work in West Hollywood. I used to run bars around there. I used to run with those types of people that are in the book.
Yep.
Does that come from stories directly from your life?
Or
do you kind of live in that world? Is that what inspired you to write the book?
Yeah, I lived in West Hollywood for a couple of years in a big house with a lot of guys. Sort of this big, you know, dilapidated mansion that kind of hovered over Sunset Boulevard, and I was in the thick of it, and I started a book, a chapter one of my first novel for years, and I could never sort of get the story. I'd never had the story, and then after I lived there for a couple of years, even though that section of the book is just sort of a part, maybe even a third, maybe a fourth of it, I had the other story came into place, and I was, after that experience, kind of settled down, and that I was able to the rest of the story revealed itself to me, and I left LA, I went back up to Berkeley, and lived in my publisher's extra room, and wrote, and it took me 2 years and 9 months.
How did you find your publisher initially?
So I
submitted some stuff, or
this is back when Kickstarter and all that stuff I think I was the first novelist on Kickstarter, so I was always encouraged I had a couple of guys from that I went to Berkeley with that wanted to get into publishing, and they'd always wanted me to write a book, and I'd talked to them for years about wanting to write a book, and then finally they were just like, just do it, man. I had a popular blog at that point. I had a Tumblr with like 350,000 followers, and I was just sort of, you know, writing little snippets or thoughts, and it was, people were engaging with it. So I had a sort of a base, a foundation. And so these guys would encourage me just to like quit my job and go, you know, write the next, you know, great American novel. And finally I did it, and we were able to, so these guys formed a group, a publishing company, a small imprint based in Berkeley, and we were able to raise 15 grand from my Tumblr followers on Kickstarter, and then they ended up giving that to me as an advance just to live off of, and then they covered all the other costs. So I lived very meagerly over those 3 years on that amount, and obviously they covered my rent and all that, but I just wrote all day, every day.
It seemed to work out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was awesome. And I still get, you know, multiple messages a day from people on that book, about that book, how it affected them. People are still discovering it, reading it, and writing me letters, writing me messages about what it meant to them. And, you know, so that's cool.
Yeah. Those of you who are listening, the book is called Isn't It Pretty to Think So by Nick Miller. You can find it on Amazon. Definitely check it out. It's a great read. And especially if you're in that age range, it's perfect for those 20 somethings,
the millennials,
the evil millennials,
yeah, exactly,
as they live. So are you writing another novel now?
No.
Or are you just looking? No, you're not writing any more novels. You're a screenwriter only now.
Well, I started writing another novel shortly after I'd finished the first one, and you know, the first one, to be honest, it took a lot out of me. It was 3 years is a long time to sort of, and I, you know, I did become a little bit of a hermit. I didn't see people. It was hard on my family. You know, my mom thought I needed like, you know, therapy. And I mean, I probably did.
It was a quintessential writer's lifestyle in a way.
And when you don't see people that, you know, for that long, and you're like, just working, you kind of become a little bit crazy. You know, I was like talking to myself in the mirror and doing all this stuff. So
you were talking to yourself in the mirror.
Yeah, you talking to me? You talking to me? You know, I don't know, because I gave everything in me to that book. I lived that lifestyle, and I poured everything onto the page. I don't know, with a family and all of that and responsibilities, I don't know if I could do that again unless I found, you know, a way to balance it better. But I don't know that. Screenwriting to me I can achieve the balance with that. You know, I can go find the madness and then come out of it. With the novel, I was never able to come out of it. You know, even when I stopped writing.
You were just completely committed the entire time.
Yes.
You weren't able to pull yourself out of that focused zone that you needed to be in
exactly.
order to finish that novel, because that was all that was
yes.
required of you. And
yes.
you were absolutely committed to just doing that and that only.
Yep.
And
exactly.
Here we are in Venice with the beautiful sirens
yes.
going by. So I apologize to my listeners. Until we get the soundproof studio here in Venice, we're going to have to deal with some of that.
I think
anyway,
it adds to the charm.
Yes, I think it does. You know, I just came from North Carolina. I was at a wedding in this beautiful little idyllic town called Lake Junaluska.
Mm, nice.
And we stayed in this bed and breakfast overlooking the lake. And the only thing I heard for 3 days was beautiful bird songs and cicadas.
Oh,
and it
I need
was,
some of that.
It was so lovely. It
yeah.
was a rude awakening coming back home.
Yeah. yeah. Back in the grind.
Yes, definitely. So as far as the screenwriting is concerned, I know that you have a number of projects going
yes.
on right now.
Mm-hmm.
And you just finished your first short film as a director
yes.
with your partner, Johnny Zwick.
Yep, which you starred in.
Yes, yes. And apparently, so far, the response has been fairly good.
Yeah, it's pleasantly surprised, which is awesome. We you know, you never know when you're going to make something, how it's going to turn out. And
you had this idea in your mind for a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
About the caption contest and, you know, that whole idea.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, and it's funny because I watched you in a play. What play was that?
It was the Eugene O'Neill play.
Eugene O'Neill play, yeah. yeah, right. So in the local theater here in Venice, I went with my wife, Cam, and we watched Ron in a play, watching in a play, and that stayed in my head. And then, you know, Johnny Zwick is my writing partner, and we have 15 shorts that are spec'd out and features and all this stuff. And then we kind of focused on this one. I was like, you know what? Ron would be perfect for this. You know, and Johnny, with my conviction, the way that I said it, I talked about the play, I showed him pictures. He didn't push back at all. So we reached out to you, and you hopped on, and then it was sort of this incredible journey that happened relatively quickly.
It was amazing. That was one of those projects, and it happens ever so often where the gods just seem to align.
Aligns.
And all the right team members were available at the right time.
Yeah.
And they were able to collaborate.
That's right.
It was like we clapped our hands and the team came together
and that
to make
rare,
this happen.
And you know this town. You've been in this town for a long time.
A long time.
Rarely happens.
Rarely happens.
So you brought up a great DP, John Orphan, that ended up working out and he signed on. And he's incredible. And I've developed a pretty strong rapport with him since then. So that came from you. You also recommended we needed a strong female lead for this. And then you recommended Rachel Avery. So Johnny and I drove down to Hollywood and met with her. After that lunch, she agreed to be a part of it. So this all, like, just like you said, it aligned and came together so fast.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden we have a DP. We have our two leads. Now we just got to crew this thing up. John Orphan, you know, takes it, brings his whole team on. Now we're ready to go. So, and then, so this whole thing comes together. And even if it all comes together, you don't know if the story's going to be good or if it's all going to, you know, you don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And then
we were so fortunate to bring John on because he has his crew and he has editors
yes.
and he's just such a talented guy. And I have the utmost respect for his artistic vision and the people that he brings in his life with him to create
yep.
whatever he's working on. There's always great people involved. And so having him be involved was just a major coup.
And not to mention he's incredibly talented.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. He's just a really good guy and a very talented man.
Makes it look good.
Yeah, yeah. So the movie came out good.
It came out really good.
I'm so happy that I was able to be involved in it, man.
Yeah,
and thank you for reaching
out.
You were
so professional. Johnny and I still talk about that, man. You showed up ready to work. And that was awesome. You know, everything... You were just a pro, and that was really refreshing.
Right. I appreciate that. And so, needless to say, that little short film got accepted into the LA International Short Film Festival,
yep.
which is, so if you're in that world, keep an eye out for
the end
caption
of the,
contest.
Yeah, keep an eye out. Come watch it debut. It's gonna premiere in LA there, so we don't know the exact date yet, but...
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
It should be fun.
Awesome. So, it's going to kick off the festival season with this festival, and hopefully we get into a few more. Maybe travel a little bit and have a little fun with it.
I have a feeling that it'll get into one or two more. I mean, if you can get into LA International.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's a good one.
It's a good feather in your cap to be able to do that. So what initially brought you to Venice? I know that you and Cam had been together kind of beforehand, or did you...
So after the...
You moved in together for the first time right up here, right?
Yes. So after we had this sort of four-day, you know, magical...
A four-day date in the desert.
First date, four days.
And she drove out to the desert to meet you.
Well, actually, I drove down over to pick her up and drove back.
Oh, okay.
Because I'm a classy guy, Ron.
He was just like, yeah, you can come spend 4 days with me. Just drive out to the desert.
Yeah, exactly. Sounds pretty crazy now thinking about it. But so that's when I first met, you know, her officially, and then her dog, which is Mick, and now is my dog.
I actually met Mick before you, by the way. Yeah. Mick used to like me before you came onto the scene, just so you know, because Cammy was my neighbor before you guys really got together, and every once in a while I'd walk by and there'd be Mick, and of course I was like the only guy hanging around the neighborhood, so Mick was kind of cool with me up until you came along.
And then I took over.
Now he ignores me, basically. He's
only got room for one person to love, and that's me. So they both hop in my car and we go up to the Palm Springs and have this this awesome time. So then it was like, what now? And I was fresh off coming writing the book, and I didn't live anywhere. I was just trying to sort of acclimate back into the real world. And you know, because this thing happened with Cam, I was like, okay, well, I need to be in LA. So I came down and got a place in Marina Del Rey, which was like a month-to-month thing, and that lasted about 6 months. And then I moved to Playa Vista with my sister, and that was for about a year. And then at this point, Cam and I were dating, like full-on dating at this point, when we both didn't think it was going to be that. We both thought we were just having this experience together and then moving on. But and then at that point, I moved in down the street from you. Actually, right next door.
Right next door.
I live now, and we lived there for a couple years together, and then we bought a house four houses down, so down the street from you still.
Yeah. So it was just the winds, the currents of life sort of brought you to this neighborhood.
It all goes back to the book, man. So if anyone's listening to this and is thinking about writing a book, write your book.
Somebody put a quote on one of my social pages. It's like, do your big thing.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is, anything that has been gnawing at you.
Yeah.
Do it.
Oh yeah. Do it.
Now, this podcast is one of those things. I actually had the initial idea for this podcast a few years ago, and I was inspired by The Village Voice.
Yep.
Out of New York. And it was sort of a voice, an international voice that started very locally.
Yep.
And became sort of a moral center for art and entertainment and all kinds of different things. And I figured something like that could happen here. And I saw that the domain was available and I didn't buy it initially, the VeniceVoice.com name. And somebody placed that quote on my wall, do your big thing. And it was like, if you have any ideas, just do it now. And when about 9 years ago, I also do some freelance work for a software company. And when they first hired me, I was doing podcast production for marketing materials. And I always wanted to do my own podcast.
Yeah.
And that's how it all kind of started for me. So I finally got the VeniceVoice.com name, and here we are. So
absolutely.
Who knows what'll happen?
Yeah. And it's Venice is a fitting, you know, hub for this, because it sort of is that.
It's about a little under 40,000 people, and it's 3.1 square miles.
Look at that. So, and look how much is happening here in such a small
The history of this town is a little astonishing, to be quite honest, with the amount of influential people that have lived and worked and created in this little place over the time that it has been around as an incorporated town, or at least it was before Los Angeles kind of took it over, is astonishing. Everyone from, you know, Angelica Houston to Basquiat and, you know, like Andy Warhol hung out down here. I mean, even our friend Tom knew all those guys.
Yeah, he hung out with those guys. Yeah, Tom Everhart.
There's a little block, Market Street, between Pacific and Speedway that used to be an enclave for artists. And there was like five or six artist studios down there. And so many world-renowned artists had their studios there, had shows there. So many musicians have come from here.
Yeah.
The Doors and, you know, Suicidal Tendencies and the punk scene and the skate and surf scene.
Yep, yep.
I mean, it's on and on and on. And now, of course, it's the hub for technology and startups and things like that. So there's something about this place that seems to draw people to come and live their dreams, much like Hollywood. I mean, Venice in some ways has been like Hollywood 2, Hollywood 1A, you know, as a place to come and explore and discover. And it's kind of like a fringe of Hollywood. You know, Roger Corman used to have his studios down here. It used to be right next door to where Google is now.
Yeah.
And he was making all of those independent films right down there. That was where his studio was. And he made hundreds of films down there for these low budget and started the careers of many, many directors. On and on, and like John Carpenter, and on and on. So this little place is just fascinating. And there's something in the soil here. It's interesting that I have you sitting here, because you and Cammy kind of have this entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, Cam especially, and you as a writer, it just seems to encapsulate that idea. Do you feel very at home here now that you've sort of placed roots?
100%. And I just want to say, you gave me goosebumps describing Venice. So my love for this town is real. But yeah, I mean, Cammy started a company, a clothing line called Show Me Your Moo Moo, and she was working out of basically a garage in Venice for years. And now they have a large warehouse downtown, where and the business has grown enormously since then. But Cammy has been in Venice for 10, 12 years, and that's she was Venice to me before I knew Venice. And then, you know, it does feel like we're both meant to be here, and I feel that way when I walk down the street. I mean, people know my dog's name, you know, like, I feel at home here. I feel, and Cammy feels the same way. And for a while she would say that, the company's tagline would be sort of kind of like based in Venice or came from Venice. And it has that feel. And you're right. There's something in the soil here, because there are a lot of beach towns and there are a lot of other places that have all the ingredients to be what this place is, but they're not. And it's like, why? And I don't know. It's something about this little 3-mile patch of beach town is just brings in people from all over the world. And there's something you feel. Everyone wants to be here. And now you have Googles and Snapchats and Facebooks, all these people coming here, and they want a piece of this too. There's just an energy here.
Yeah,
and you can't fake an energy.
Yeah, it's so astonishing. There are currently 52 individual startup companies in this little 3.1 square mile town that are all trying to start their businesses. It's pretty amazing, considering that it was just basically supposed to be a giant amusement park.
Yeah.
You know, when Abbot Kinney built it, not only was he trying to impress a woman that lived in Europe who loved Venice, but he wanted it to be an amusement park. It was basically a place where people would come and have a vacation cottage and ride roller coasters and little cute trains around a neighborhood and then leave. And when it was first built, there was nothing between here and Sunset Boulevard. It was just marshland. And there was this little teeny vision of fun and discovery. And I think that it's kind of because I think imbued the land with that or put that idea here.
Right.
It kind of took root.
Yeah.
And it flowered in that sort of creative way. I that sounds a little odd and metaphysical,
I love that.
But I think that you can feel it in the ground here.
Yep.
As opposed to like Hollywood, where, you know, dreams go to die in a way. You know, it just feels so different.
Yep.
You know, it just chews people up in a lot of ways.
It's just the ghosts of dreams. Just
just
meandering, floating down the Sunset Boulevard, just looking for
disappearing
shelter
into the ground.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, we're very, very fortunate and so blessed to be able to live here, man. It's cool. You know, I used to have It just made me miss my dog. I used to have a hound dog. It was a big old hound dog named Clyde, and I would walk him around here all the time. And it's the same thing. I've lived here for so long that I've become a part of the community in many ways.
Yeah.
And I know all the neighbors, and they used to like hang out with my dog, and I used to dog sit for a lot of people. And it's really a community. It's one of the very few communities in Los Angeles where, you know, right now I work from home. I don't get in the car unless I absolutely have to.
Oh, yeah.
And I can walk to the post office, to the grocery store, to get food, whatever I need. Mm-hmm. And it's really great to have that kind of a community, especially in this sprawling city that we live in.
Exactly. I mean, I don't even have a car. So there you go. My wife does, but I mean, we use it, we share it. But I mean, I don't even technically have one because I don't need one.
That's,
you know,
refreshing.
And that's rare in Los Angeles.
Very rare.
Angeles is synonymous with car, you know, in most people's minds.
Yeah.
Here, we're sort of able to escape all that, which is great, you know.
What is this fascination you have with quotes? What your Instagram with the quotes? What's going on with that? What was the inspiration?
So that is as you know, a lot of things in this town can take forever, and there's this massive waiting game. So you finish a project, unless you're doing it yourself, like we did with our short, or you're raising the money on your own, or you're just completely taking everything on and doing it yourself. There's a lot of waiting, and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of people have to weigh in and all this. So the Instagram thing happened as a creative outlet for me to express myself in those down periods, and just to like have a voice and play around. That's where that came from. So Instagram is a place where I can just like put up quick little sound bites, or like, and that's the only way is effective, really, is if you keep it short and simple. So it's like a game for me. I try to just do something really simple that can have an impact on people. And it's like a little challenge, you know? And it's just like a fun thing for me. And it seems to resonate with some people. So,
well, it seems very healthy to me too, because like you said, the process of being in entertainment or wanting to be in the entertainment industry as a whole, it can be extremely frustrating.
Yes.
You know, if we put all of our creative output or expectations on the results of what we may or may not get from the entertainment industry, it can drive one mad.
You're screwed.
And I've gone through it. I've had many different phases in my life where things have been going really well, and then you're waiting, and you never know what's going to happen. It's an ebb and a flow.
Big time.
And I've seen it destroy a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
And so having a creative outlet like that must be extremely beneficial.
Yeah, and I have this like 1926 typewriter. It's a Royal Deluxe, the same model that Hemingway used. So when I'm feeling frustrated, or like I want to say something or get something off my chest, or just feel like I'm creating, just go in my room, my office, and just kind of like bang away at it and like take pictures of it and put it up online. And it's, you know, I'm not a poet. I'm not trying to be super serious with it.
You're not trying to be like so cool that people admire you because you just have these super like funny and very insightful little quotes on Instagram. Check me out.
No, I mean, I don't even have a picture of myself up there. I guess I do stories, but I just try to make it about fun little, make it about the words. It all comes back to the writing and the words for me. Words fulfill me, and it's just a fun little creative expression for me.
That's another thing that you and I have in common. I've been a fan of oration and storytelling and words my entire life. It really has consumed most of what I do. I love storytelling. I love acting. And your Instagram page resonates with me, and I love it just because language is the most important thing we have.
100%.
As human beings.
Yeah.
Being able to tell a story in a little soundbite like that has a real resonance there's something really kind of creative and cool about it. And I really enjoy it.
And especially if you give yourself some parameters, you're like, okay, you know, I'm going to write something in not so many words, and I'm going to try to have a big impact. That's a fun challenge, because most of the times you're going to fail, but sometimes you win, you walk away like, you know, feeling like you contributed to something, even though it's just a little Instagram post, which is why we're all doing this, right? To communicate, to contribute a little bit, to be a part of the conversation, you know.
And it was one of those things. And that also has turned into a little business for you, right?
Yeah, yeah. So now I, you know, a guy named John Rothermill reached out to me, and he sort of become my like Instagram art manager, and he takes like some of the more popular ones and turns them into prints and cards. We're in like several card stores and a couple in Los Angeles and then a couple in Atlanta, I think. Have to check with him on that.
So you do stationary stores and yeah, cards.
Yeah, exactly.
And
it's just a like fun that. Little side hustle. You know, it's nothing crazy, but it's another fun little project. You know, we're about the projects, Ron.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. And I like the fact that it turns into something that not only resonates with people, but it's something that can turn into a little business.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it cracks me up. I have so many friends, and I've gone through this in my life where I've sort of banged my head against the wall looking for the next thing, you know, and looking for the thing that I'm going to be able to monetize.
Yep.
And oftentimes the best things are the things that I do just because it comes from the heart, just because it entertains me, I love doing it so much. And so I just put it out there and see what happens. And then all of a sudden, Something grows.
Yeah.
You can't, like planting a seed.
You can't half-ass anything. And if you're not doing anything with your heart behind it and all of you, it's not going to be real. It's not going to be authentic, you know? But if you do something with your whole heart and you put everything into it, something may come from that. And the money may come from that.
Maybe. But
maybe
also,
not.
Yeah,
you know?
Maybe not. But at least I have spent my time in ways that are valuable to me.
Yeah.
I mean, doing things that we love. And listen, I know that there's a lot of people out there that think, man, I can't do that. I don't have the resources or the time, or I have a family or whatever it is to do those things, to pursue those creative outlets, to do the things that I've always dreamed of doing. And then there are so many people that spend the significant portion of their healthy life doing things that they hate to do.
Yeah, I never understood that. I guess I can see how easy it is to fall into that.
Like,
and
having
I'm not
a regular job
criticizing that at all.
Not at all.
But we don't know what we have next. This is, as far as we know, we got one life here, and like, you know, why not at least part of the time do something that makes you feel alive?
Yeah.
You know?
Amen.
And now there's so many less barriers to entry. Like Soderbergh just shot that movie on an iPhone.
Yeah, and he's saying he's going to shoot all of his movies
exactly.
on iPhone.
So I mean, you know, essentially, me and you can go make a movie right now.
Yeah.
And well, that's cool.
We basically did do that, by the way. But, luckily we had the resources around us to do it.
Exactly. But yeah, you know, there's really are no excuses if you want to create content. You just gotta do it and try and fail and then try again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Failure is just part of the process.
Oh, man.
And it's not a failure.
Yeah. No.
Failure,
you learn.
Yeah. It was a very profound moment when I realized, and this was, it took a while. I mean, when we're young, we don't fully understand this. I took failure very hard when I was younger. I was always governed by what people thought of me.
Yep.
I was very interested in what you thought of me.
Right.
And when I didn't think that you thought well of me, I took it very hard.
Right.
It was partially because of the way that I was raised and, you know, partially some abandonment things that happened when I was younger. But when I finally got the idea and fully understood that no one is, quote, successful all the time.
Yeah.
No one is perfect. There is no perfect. It doesn't exist. And
no
without
way.
Stumbling, without falling and getting up and going through that process, there's no learning unless we do that.
Yeah.
We have to go through that in order to come through the other side and be stronger and learn from our mistakes and move forward. And especially in a creative pursuit.
Oh gosh. it's 90% failure.
Yeah.
You know? And like you said, it's not really failing because you're learning, you're readjusting. You're coming back to it with the knowledge that you've accrued, and you're doing it again as a wiser person, and a more seasoned person, and then you have you're sort of hardened over a little, like the things that maybe destroyed you early on, they can't touch you anymore.
Yeah.
Like as you probably have as well, I've had times where I thought something big was about to happen, and then the last minute it falls through. You're just demoralized, early on. And then you realize that that's just part of this whole thing. Yeah. And now it happens. It's like, okay, what's next? You know? Yeah. And then the idea is to have 10 rings in the fire and maybe one will catch and you know, if not, you keep add more, you know.
Yeah, we've all been in those situations. I remember I was hired to be the lead in an independent feature film. It was a really good thing. I had the contract signed. Yep. All was good. I had money. And they'd given me some like money, all right? And then the day before we were supposed to shoot, I got a call at like midnight and they said that they were going to push it a couple of days and then it never happened.
Yeah.
And it can be extremely demoralizing. I was crushed, you know.
Yeah.
You know, of course, in my head, in my grandiose mind at the time when I was younger, I'm thinking, okay, Academy Award, here I come.
Yep.
I'm already practicing my speech.
Yeah. But you got to believe that, you know, that's just, I mean, you got to be, what is that saying? Like, you know, only, or was it you got to be stupid enough to believe that you can actually make it?
Absolutely.
You know? Whatever. I mean, I believe in the cat, like you got to just sort of carry that tune. And another story that I had was a couple years ago, I had a deal in my hand to write a full length feature for these Canadian guys who wanted to make a comedy. Money was all set up. Contract was in my hand. I had a writing partner. We were ready to go. Was going to go down to Canada to study the life there, study these guys. And then the head of that studio got fired. And then the new person came in and like wiped it all the projects off the table. I had a contract in my hand.
Yeah, anything that affiliated with that guy was
just
now gone.
Yeah. And so all of a sudden, like, and it's not just like a contract's given to you overnight. There's months of, you know, pitches and talks and thousands of emails. And I was so demoralized, but then you realize that happens all the time. And you just got to get hard into that.
Yeah, I had a pretty big agent for a while, and he got fired, and all of his clients were wiped just away. Poof, that was yep, it. And gone. So there I was with no representation starting right from the beginning. And that particular agent had, I don't want to say a stench around him, but
right,
he didn't have a great reputation after he got fired. So anybody that he had represented in the past really wasn't being considered for a while.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there was years there where I had nobody that was willing to step up and say, we'll represent you,
right,
you know? So regardless, as a creative person, we just kind of have to keep forging ahead, man, and do the things that
and
we love
to
do.
And you actually said something to me when we were first meeting about the short film that we were about to do. You said that it's not about where it all ends up. It's about the journey and to learning to appreciate the work while you're doing it. And not going into it thinking, is this going to get nominated? Is this going to win this? Is this going to change our lives? It's about being thankful for the opportunity to sit in a room and talk creative thoughts and ideas and then make something together. Because that a lot of people don't get it, aren't in the position to do that.
Not at all.
So that's...
No, we were so blessed and are still so blessed
yeah,
to be able to
we'll,
have these
we'll
opportunities.
Do more.
Yeah, yeah, we're going to do more.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people, and this is another lesson that I learned over the past few years, is that I cannot live in the results of anything.
No.
There's only appreciating what's happening right here and right now.
Yeah.
Like having this conversation. You know, it's so great that we get to be completely engaged with one another right now.
Yeah, 100%.
It's so odd. It's so rare that we get to sit down and have a conversation with anyone.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether or not we're recording it or doing it for any particular reason, we're so distracted by electronics or information or whatever
right
it is. There's one or two other things I wanted to just mention. Looking at you and Cam and this little life that you've put together,
mm-hmm,
I mean, from the outside, it looks idyllic.
Right.
Like, were you always hoping to like settle down and have a family?
No.
Because it seems to me like you kind of have this, and I know no situation is perfect, no relationship is perfect, but
yep,
you guys have this, you know, you're young and successful and have a house here in mm-hmm Venice and a beautiful baby and like the world is kind of your oyster.
Yeah.
And you're in you know, you have a great family. Cam's got a great family.
Mm-hmm.
You got a lot
yep
of support around you. Blessed for that.
Definitely.
But you've been able to make it, you've been able to put it together. And did it just happen or did you just like, this is what we're doing and that's it?
No, I mean, I didn't think I would ever get married or have kids. I loved the idea maybe of thinking about having kids one day, but I was I didn't think I would ever get married. I was not on that path. And then one thing happened and my trajectory just shifted and changed. And I rode that wave, and it's been incredible. But by no means was I ever planning for any of this to happen, nor was I set on any of this happening. So I think maybe that makes it more organic and realer, because I waited till it was real, or waited till the right person and the right situation presented itself, maybe. And I didn't try to force it, I guess, because I didn't even want it. I mean, to be honest, I didn't. I wanted to. I mean, after I wrote my novel, at the end of the novel, a little bit of a spoiler, but at the end of the novel, the lead character, it's implied that he is heading to New Orleans. So I did that purposely, because I applied for jobs to be like a truck driver in New Orleans, or something ridiculous like that, because I wanted to learn.
Not that truck driving is ridiculous.
No, sorry. So ridiculous for me, because I don't know how to drive a truck. I don't get it. It's just ridiculous in that sense. But I literally sent off applications for jobs like that, because I wanted to be in New Orleans learning about that way of life, so I could write another novel out there. And I've always, and obviously, you know, there's not a lot of money in novels or anything like that. I just wanted to sort of be a vagabond and like create and drift around and meet people. And now I have a home in Venice with a wife and a daughter. So there's a story in that too, as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, you know, for guess. Sure.
So
I've been talking to a lot of people about this podcast, mm-hmm. and what it can be, what it could be. There's a lot of talk around the many issues that sort of plague this area as well. For all of its upside, there are some serious problems that yep. are going on around here.
Yep.
There's a lot of overpopulation. There's a lot of traffic. And, of course, the homeless
yes.
problem.
Yes.
How has it affected you? What do you think some of the main causes are, and what do you think that we should do? They're talking about changing the bus yard over there on Main Street
yeah.
into a homeless encampment, building something there, putting a lot of money into
right.
getting people in one area so that they can transition them into real life, give them services and things like that. What do you think about that idea?
So obviously, as you know, this is a huge hot topic in this town right now, and we're all sort of following it. And my perspective is adjusted because I've become a homeowner. So I've looked at things a little bit differently. But I think the main thing is that we need to have the foundation of empathy, and we need to remember that for homeless people are people, and we need to understand that and empathize. But I also think that Venice does not need to support all of Los Angeles. I think that other people can share the burden. Not that it's a burden, you know what I mean? We could all sort of contribute
and share the responsibility.
Share the responsibility, better word, thank you, of addressing this problem, because it is a real problem. but I think right now, you know, a lot of coastal cities and even a lot of inland cities are looking at Venice as like the problem solver, and I think that would be a little imbalanced, in my opinion.
There's a gentleman I was speaking with earlier this morning who's been around here for a long time, and he sees, and he's been here since the mid-80s, and he's a very influential guy, and he sees Venice as a microcosm of Los Angeles and Los Angeles as a microcosm of the rest of the country, and he thinks and wants to put in place policies here in Venice that can be copied in Los Angeles and
yeah.
in the rest of the country.
Yeah.
And he feels like it has to come from the community, that we should not rest our laurels on politicians.
Right, yes.
And as a community, figure out ways to be more empathetic, like you said, and to take actions to help encourage those who are able to help them get off the streets in ways that are really tangible. Like, some people don't have social security cards. Some people
right.
don't have driver's licenses. Some people don't have
right.
any support whatsoever. They've gotten to a place where their friends and family don't want to have anything to do with them anymore. Right. So they have nowhere else to turn.
So they're stuck in the mud.
Right. So as a community, we could maybe be that bridge for them.
Exactly.
And reach out and say, hey, maybe we can help you get your Social Security card, or maybe we can help you get your driver's license and get you at least into a place where you can take the next step.
Right. 100%. Which is, because think about how many people could... Something could result from that.
Oh, no question.
You know?
I think that it could...
If you're given a chance.
I think that that's it's somewhat altruistic. I think that it's a big idea that could catch on if it had enough support in the community.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as a creative leader, as a community that it has been for so long, it's possible that an idea like that could catch fire.
Yeah.
You know, I would be into it. For sure.
Definitely.
But it really isn't about people donating their time and effort. A lot of people are more than willing to write a check, but they're not willing to walk down on the street and say, hey, man, how are we going to be able to help you? And because they're afraid, too. I mean, there's a huge contingent of people who are genuine lawbreakers, who are taking advantage of those homeless people, who are coming in and, in some ways, painting the entire population of homeless people as bad people.
Right.
And they're definitely not.
Yeah,
there are men and
not.
Women and children on the streets here
that
all they would really need is a leg up without just, you know, asking for another $1 billion from the city to put them in one spot.
One spot.
That is going to be a Band-Aid.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, it's a fascinating conversation. And I remember when I first moved here, because I've been here for over 20 years, and I remember there's always been RVs on Venice Boulevard.
Right.
There's always been people living in their vans.
Right.
It's the weather it lends itself.
Yeah.
And I'm from San Francisco originally, and I moved here from the Hate. So it was basically the Hate on the beach when I came here.
Which
initially.
Is appealing.
For me, it was great.
Yeah.
It was exactly what I wanted. And it was just... Initially, it was because it was the most inexpensive place to live.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. Not even close. But I think that, you know, the thought leadership is here, and you know, the problem has gotten to the point where real change can happen. And I, you know, and part of what I would like to do with this audience that I hope to create is to maybe just keep talking about it.
Definitely.
Maybe find a way to create some community and some real action to make some positive changes in our little community. And maybe it will resonate out to the city or to the rest of the country.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this conversation needs to continue to happen. There's a lot of anger right now, and as we're witnessing on a national scale, when there's a lot of anger, nothing gets accomplished. So we just have to sort of sit down and talk. And Venice is a great place, I think, for that conversation, that local conversation to happen.
Yeah. So what's next for you, Nick? What are you working on? I know that John didn't give me the full scoop on this latest project that you were working on.
Right.
I think that he was kind of holding it close to the vest.
Yeah. So John Orphan, who was the DP, the cinematographer on the short film that Ron and I worked on, we like I said earlier, we developed a rapport, and then, you know, John came to me with an idea about a feature, a thriller set in rural Washington around solving a murder, a cold case that's been cold for 20 years or so. So he came to me with this general idea. We ended up working, hashing some things out, and then, you know, I wrote the screenplay, and now we're taking meetings on it. We're seeing there's some interest, and we're seeing where it's going to go. But hopefully we can make a feature-length film together, which would be awesome.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
I want John and you to make more feature films.
Yeah.
I think it would definitely be worthwhile, to say the least. And you got other scripts going on as well. Are you and Johnny Zwick going to be making some more shorts?
Yeah. So we have another short that we want to, that we're very happy with, the script. So we're hoping to keep the momentum going from the last short. And quickly shoot this, or not quickly, but shoot this one so that we can have a couple of those in the works. And then we have a couple of feature ideas. And then I just got approached by some independent EPs to develop a TV show based off a novel that they secured the rights to. So right now we're in the contract phase. So
no guarantees
there. But that could be a project that I'm going to jump onto and spend a few months on. Which is exciting, because I read the novel And I sparked to it, and I sent a pitch back, and they agreed, and hopefully we can move forward on that. So those are sort of the things that are all circling my creative life right now. And I also write little children's books that I just store away for a later time in my life, maybe. But I have a few of those building up.
Yeah, just something maybe to
pursue later.
Gift your daughter.
Yeah,
someday.
Maybe. Yeah, read just maybe at the bare minimum, just read to her. So, which I can't wait for that phase of my life where I can. Well, I read to her now, but she doesn't understand what the hell's going on. But I can't wait till I can read to her and talk to her. It's gonna be a fun time for me.
So adorable, man. I'm just really happy for you guys, and I'm just very, very grateful that I came to know you,
yeah,
and we
absolutely
had the opportunity to work together, and I just can't thank you enough for coming, sitting down, and talking to me, man.
You know what's crazy is that we knew each other for a while, in passing, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, we lived next door to each other. We always had a pleasant conversation. But it wasn't until I saw you in that play, and then we sort of took our relationship to a creative relationship, that we became kind of close friends and all that. So it's really cool how that sort of organically formed.
Yeah.
You know,
I agree. And, you never know what's right downstairs.
Exactly.
Or right. You never know who your neighbors are, man.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, exactly.
Don't take anything for granted as we're walking around here.
I
mean, just within, you know, 5 blocks of us, there are probably 50 or 100 like-minded people.
Oh man. Someone is at the coffee shop, on the corner is writing the next great screenplay right now.
No question.
You know,
and I mean, somebody's making the next beautiful painting.
Oh
and,
yeah.
And there are, endless composers, musicians, and
you walk
bands
down the street, you hear music, you know, just sort of billowing out of windows. It's just a really cool creative place, and I'm happy to live here.
Yeah, me too, man. I'm glad you're a part of it. I'm glad we met, and once again, man, thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, man.
I just want to say thank you once again to Nick Miller for taking the time to speak with us today. I really enjoyed that conversation, and I hope you did too. His book, Isn't It Pretty to Think So, is still available on Amazon. Should pick it up. It's really a great read. Also, if you want to follow him on his Instagram, it's _Nick Miller. Now, just a reminder, if you want to follow us, we're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @Venice Voice. Once again, I just want to remind you before I go that this podcast is for you. So if you'd like to be interviewed, or if there's something that you'd like to talk about, a local event or an issue that you'd like to bring up, or maybe a product you'd like to pitch, give me a shout at ron@venicevoice.com. Tune in again next time when I'll have another person from here in Venice. Thanks once again. This is The Venice Voice.